very important because this substance has much more energy in it than this. And just like there's a box for carrying hydrogen atoms around, a special hydrogen atom carrier in living things, there are also special energy-carrying substances which involve the triphosphate group. So this has more energy than that. And if the cycle is going this way, we're generating an energy object which has extra energy. It can go in some other cycle and which requires energy to drive it and drive it around. It, for example, is required in the muscle. The muscle will not contract unless there's ATP present. You can make the very substances of, you can take a muscle apart, take the substance, put them in water, and add ATP, the things contract, as long as energy is supplied, if the right enzymes are present. So the real system is here. And in the dark, if GTP has been stored up during the day, the whole thing will run around the other way. Because with enzyme, you see, it doesn't care which way it carries. It can't care which way it carries, or we'd get against one of the laws of physics. But we won't worry about that now. Now, one of the things that I would say this, that if it were not for the development of physics, these charts would not be known today. And the reason is that the most useful tool of all for analyzing this entire business, because you can see what a terrific mess there is of all those substances in the cell, is to label the atoms. It's to put in carbon dioxide, which has a green mark on it. And then watch after 3 seconds. Where's the green mark? You find it in here. 10 seconds. It's in here. And so on. So you can trace these things out. Now, what are the green marks? They're the different isotopes. You know that chemically, substances determine the chemical properties by the number of electrons, because that determines the outside, and not by the character of the nucleus. But there can be, for example, in carbon, there must be 6 protons to be carbon. But there can be 6 neutrons, or, for instance, 7 neutrons. Chemically, they're the same, but they weigh differently, and they have different nuclear properties, and so they can be distinguished. So by using either isotopes of different weight, or even radioactive isotopes, which is a little more sensitive way even for small quantities, why it's possible to trace this out. And this chart is the result of the discovery of isotopes and radioactivity. Now let me return to the description of the enzymes and the proteins. All proteins are not enzymes, but all enzymes are proteins. Oh, I forgot to say an important thing. The enzymes are all different and run different reactions. Most of the reactions that are indicated on these charts are reactions which are common to all cells. But if you need, for instance, a red pigment for the eye of a fly, then what happens is that you take one of these substances somewhere and make a side reaction, the fly does, with another enzyme, which changes into something else, ending up as a red pigment for that eye. So that a different fly, which has a different color, will have different enzymes. And the real thing that determines what the thing is the system of enzymes which is manufactured, because the pattern of enzyme controls all the chemical reactions and all the products. Whether, in other words, it's a fly or a leaf is merely a question of the system of enzymes which is available in the cell, so that the leaf doesn't make fly eye pigment. Now, the enzymes are proteins, as I said, but not all proteins are enzymes. There are many proteins, such as the proteins in muscle. The proteins are structural proteins that, for example, in cartilages, in hair, in skin, and so on, that are not enzymes themselves. But proteins are a very characteristic substance of life. First of all, it can make all the enzymes. And second, it makes so much of the rest of the material. The proteins, however, have a very interesting and simple structure. There are a series or a chain of amino acids. An amino acid has an acid group somewhere, I'm not sure of myself here, and an amino group hanging off, and then some side chain. That may be, I've missed a couple of atoms. Another acid group can tie on to the amino group with the liberation of water and tie on here, and another, but the amino acids all have this part in common, Perhaps there's another hydrogen in the neutral case. But there's different R's for the different amino acids. And there are 20 different R's. There are 20 different amino acids. And they all form chains in which the backbone is CNOH, CNC, and so on. But all the R's are sort of hanging loose. And so what proteins are nothing but the chains of the various different amino acids, and we can list 20 amino acids. I forgot to bring a list or a chart of the amino acids, which are put together to make a protein. Actually, each one of the amino acids probably serves some special purpose. Some of the amino acid, for example, has a sulfur atom up in here. And when two of those with sulfur atoms is in the same protein, they form a bond. That is, they link the protein. It's a hook for tying the long chain together in a loop, so that one of them, cysteine, has a sulfur atom. Another has extra oxygen atoms, which makes it an acidic substance. Others have as a basic characteristic. Some of them have big aromatic, big groups hanging off here so that it takes up a lot of space. And one of the amino acids called proline is not really an amino acid, but an amino acid. There's a slight difference, I think, in the amino group here, with the result that when that's in the chain, there's a kink in the chain. So if you want to manufacture a protein, you would give instructions. I want one of those hooks here. I want to get something that takes up space. Now put a little acidic group. Now put a kink in the chain. And so you'll get a complicated-looking chain hooked together, having some complex structure. And that's the manner in which all the various enzymes are made, presumably, as far as we know. One of the great triumphs of recent times within the last year, in fact, was at last to discover the exact arrangement of in space and the order of all the amino, some 56 or 60 amino acids in a row, over 1,000 atoms, nearly 2,000 if you count the hydrogen atom, have been all located in a complex pattern for one or now two proteins. The first was hemoglobin. One of the sad parts of this is that as far as we can tell yet, you can't see anything from the pattern. You don't understand why it works the way it does because of that pattern, but of course that's the next problem in the development. Now the other problem is, how do the enzymes know what to be? The red-eyed fly makes a red-eyed fly baby. And so the information for the whole pattern of enzymes has to be passed from one fly to the next. This is done by a substance in the nucleus of the cell. Its substance is not an enzyme, is not a protein. It's called DNA, short for desoxyribonucleic acid. And the substance that's in the center, the key substance, which is passed from one cell to the other, for instance, sperm cells consist mostly of DNA. That carries the information as to how, the instructions as to how to make the enzymes. That's the blueprint. And what does that blueprint look like? First, the blueprint must be able to reproduce itself. And second, it has to be able to instruct the protein. Now, it's easy to talk about how cells reproduce. They simply grow bigger and divide in half. And so it must be with molecules. They divide, they grow bigger and divide in half. You see, every atom grows bigger and divides in half. So you soon realize that it's impossible to reproduce a molecule except by some more clever way. The structure of the substance DNA was studied for a long time, first chemically to get the situation out, and then with X-rays to get the pattern in space. And the result of all of this is the following discovery: that the DNA molecule consists of a pair of chains twisted upon each other. The backbone of these chains, analogous to the chains of proteins, but chemically quite different, is a series of sugar and phosphate groups in a series along here, which doesn't need to concern us. It's just a long, tight, strong chain along here the same way. Attached to each sugar along the line, just like there was the R groups on the end of the amino acid, are similar R's, which are called X's. But they're not the same. There are four kinds: adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. But never mind the names. Let's call them A, B, C, and D. Here is a model of this. This discovered the form of the thing by X-rays. The lines are not parallel as I've drawn them, but are twisted in space, as here. The main chains are this one and the other one on the other side. And you see that they face each other, and attached to each chain to the sugar group are little special X's like this, pyrimidines and purines, A, B, C, D. Now, the interesting thing is that these groups sit opposite each other, for instance, A and B, so that they're put on the two chains in such a way that they fit together and have strong energy of interaction. So here's another pair, C and D, that fit together. But C will not fit with A, and B will not fit with C. Well, they will only fit in pairs, A against B and C to D. So that if that happens that this one's C, the other one must be D, and so on. That is, for whatever letters that you put in here, there must be a complementary letter on the other chain. This is the result of a study of the substance. And now, you see how it reproduces, and you see that it can contain instructions. In the first place, if I could split this chain down the middle, I would have a series, A, C, B, B, A, C, and every animal could have a different series. And perhaps there's some way where, for example, if A and C are close together, when you manufacture the protein, you put cysteine there. And if D and B are close together, it says proline goes there. And so on. It could well be that the instructions for the proteins are contained in the series of the bases on the DNA. What about the reproduction? Suppose you split this chain in two. How can you make another one just like it? Well, if in the substances of the cells there's a manufacturing department, and the cycles for that are given in the last chart, which bring up phosphate sugar pyrimidine units. Well, let's see, I'm reproducing the other side, excuse me. They bring these up loose, not connected together in the chain yet. Then the only ones which will attach will be the correct one, which is the complement of A. You see, A and B are complements, and C and D are complements. So with the chain A, if you took away this chain, it's easy to put the chain back again. So what happens is that this chain splits down the middle. One half goes in one cell. The other half goes in the other cell. It may not be quite that they separate that well. Anyway, they separate. And when it's separated, new complementary chain is made, and thus you make two out of one. In other words, to put it another way, if you want to reproduce a hand, that's quite difficult. But a hand in its mold is easy. You separate the hand and mold, put another mold around the hand, and pour clay in the other mold. Now you've got two molds and hands, you see. And that's the idea, an object and its complement. Next comes the question, precisely how is the order, does the order in these bases determine the arrangement of the amino acids in the protein? That's the central problem of biology today, unsolved. The first clues, however, the first pieces of information, however, are these. First, there are in the cell tiny particles called microsomes. It is now known that there is the place where proteins are made. Microsomes are not in the nucleus. DNA is in the nucleus. Something's the matter. But it's also known that from the DNA, little molecule pieces come off, not as long as the big DNA molecule that takes all the information from the cell, but small sections of it, which are essentially the same as the DNA, rather slightly different. There's some oxygen missing on the, there's an extra oxygen on the sugar, so it's called RNA, but that's not essential. It also has four bases and so on. So it's some kind of copy of the DNA, a short copy. And this piece of RNA, which is we call now messenger RNA because it represents a message as to what kind of protein to make, goes over to the microsome. That's known. And when it gets there, protein is synthesized at the microsome. That's also known. But the details of how the amino acids, which come in, are arranged in accordance to the code that's on the RNA, is, of course, still unknown. We don't know how to read. If we knew, for instance, the base line, the A, B, C, C, A, we couldn't tell you what protein is being made. Certainly no subject, no field is making more progress at the present moment than biology, and on so many fronts. It has so many different fronts. But the main assumption, the most powerful assumption of all, which leads one on and on in order to understand life, is the assumption that it's all made out of atoms. And that everything that the living things do, that can be understood in terms of the jigglings and wigglings of atoms, ultimately, at the deep level. So much for biology. Now I must turn, in this rapid-fire explanation of the entire world, to astronomy. And astronomy is the oldest, is older than physics. In fact, it got physics started by showing the motion of the stars and planets, and in evolving or understanding the motion of the planets was the beginning of physics. The most remarkable discovery in all astronomy is that the atoms on the stars are the same as those on the Earth. This was done this way. You know, the atoms will liberate a light which has definite frequencies, something like the timbre of a musical instrument, which has definite pitches or frequencies in the sound. And each of the atoms has a different timbre, and the eye is nowhere near as sensitive as the ear in this connection. When you're listening to several different things, you can tell them apart, but when you're looking at a mixture of colors, you can't see the parts from which it's made. So with a spectroscope, we can. In a moment we do that, we can see the tunes of the different atoms are in the stars. As a matter of fact, one of the chemical elements that was never discovered on, was discovered on a star before it was discovered on the Earth. It was discovered on the sun, helium, before it was found on the Earth. This, of course, permits us to understand the stars, because if it's made of the same kind of atoms as on the Earth, we can learn a great deal about the atoms. And the remarkable thing is, the power of the physical laws of the atoms are known well enough that they can be analyzed quite thoroughly. Especially lucky it is that the conditions in the star are high temperature, extremely high temperature, and not very great density, or, well, even when there is great density, the temperature is high enough that we can analyze by statistical mechanics, the averaging process, very accurately the behavior of the substance. Even though we can't reproduce the conditions on the Earth, we can tell precisely, or very closely, what will happen. And so it is that physics aids astronomy. We have an understanding of the distribution of matter in the interior of the sun, which is far better than our understanding of the matter in the interior of the Earth. And what goes on inside a star is better understood than you might guess from the difficulty of having only to look a little dot of light through a telescope. Well, you can figure out what the atoms should do, except in one circumstance in the stars, and that is if there's convection in the stars, we don't know how to analyze that. So there are places where we are not doing so well. One of the most impressive discoveries was the origin of the energy of the stars, what makes them keep burning. And one of the men who discovered this was out with his girl the night just after he worked it out. It was nuclear reactions. You see, the nuclear reactions were known, then he realized that they must be going on in the star, and that's why they shine. And he was out with his girl, and she said, "Look at the pretty stars." And he said, "Yes, and now I'm the only man in the world who knows why they shine." She merely laughed at him. I guess you gentlemen must understand how that is when you go out with him. But she was not impressed with being out with the man, which for that moment at least was the only one who knew where they shined. Well, it's sad to be alone, but that's the way it is in this world. This is the burning of hydrogen, which supplies the energy of the sun, to converting it to helium. And furthermore, ultimately, the manufacture of the various chemical elements are done in the star, in the centers of the stars, by hydrogen. And the stuff of which we are made was cooked once in a star and spit out. How do you know? Because there's a clue left over that the proportions of the different isotopes, how much carbon-12, how much carbon-13, and so forth, is something which is never changed by chemical reactions, because for chemical reactions, that's almost the same. It's only a result of nuclear reactions. And so in the cold, dead ember, which we are, by looking at the proportions of the isotopes of all various isotopes, we can discover what the furnace was like in which the stuff we're made of was. And that furnace is like the stars, and so it's very likely that it was made in the stars and spit out, because there are stars that explode and do various things like that. I must go much faster than I'm going. I see I haven't left myself enough time, so I'll run along, leaving lots of things in astronomy to be studied more, But I turn now to what's called the earth sciences, or geology. First, meteorology, the weather. Physics in all the sciences helps a great deal to make instruments, the machinery of the telescope, because a result of understanding the theory of light for astronomy, and enormous numbers of instruments are supplied to all the various departments of the world, of the sciences, by physics, and meteorology is one. But theory of meteorology has never been satisfactorily worked out by the physicists. You'd say, well, there's nothing to it, it's just air. You know the equations of motion of air, yeah, we do. So if you know the condition of air today, why can't you figure out what the condition of air is tomorrow? First, you don't really know exactly what it is today, because it's kind of swirling and twisting. So although you measure it here and here and here, you don't know what it's doing in between. And it turns out to be very sensitive. It's kind of unstable. If you've ever seen water run smoothly over a dam and then turn into a large number of blobs and drops as it falls, you'll understand what I mean by unstable. The water, you know the conditions of the water before it goes over the weir. It's perfectly smooth. But the moment it begins to fall, where do the drops begin? What determines how big the lumps are going to be and where they are and so on? That's not known. So it's unstable like that. So that even the smooth-moving mass of air going over a mountain turns into complex whirlpools and eddies. Again, we have the situation of a turbulent flow that we cannot analyze today. Now, quickly, I run away from the weather and talk about geology. The science of geology first was the question of how the Earth, what gets the way it is, and the most obvious processes are in front of your very eyes, the erosion processes of the rivers and the winds and so on. And it's easy enough to understand those. But for every bit of erosion, there's an equal amount of something else going on, because the mountains are no lower today, on the average, than they were in the past. There must be mountain-forming processes, and you'll find, if you wish, that in geology there's always these mountain-forming processes, tectonic this and that, which nobody understands, and which is half of geology. The phenomena, for example, of volcanoes is really not understood. What makes the earthquakes ultimately is not understood. It's understood that if something's pushing something, it snaps a little bit as it slides. That's all right. But what pushes? The theory is that there are currents inside the earth, circulating currents due to the difference in temperature from inside and outside, which, in their motion, push the surface slightly. And thus, if there's two circulations like this, we'll collect the matter in this region and make belts of mountains where it's all squashed up, which are in unhappy condition, producing volcanoes and earthquakes. What about the inside of the Earth? A great deal is known about the speed of waves through it from the earthquake waves and the density distribution of the Earth. But the physicists have been unable to get a good theory as to how dense a substance should be at the pressures that would be expected at the center of the Earth. In other words, we cannot figure out the properties of matter in these circumstances very well. We do much less well with the Earth than we do with the conditioned matter in the stars. The mathematics involved seems so far a little too difficult, but I suspect that it will not be long before somebody realizes that's an important problem and really works it out. The other aspect, of course, is even if we did know the density, the currents, the circulating currents, we can't figure out. Nor can we really work out the properties of the rocks at high pressure. You can't tell how fast they should give. And so that must all be worked out by experiment. Next, I'll talk about the science of psychology. Incidentally, psychoanalysis is not a science. It's a medical business. It's like a witch doctory. There's a theory as to what causes disease, lots of different spirits and this and that. Let's say the witch doctor has a theory that the disease is caused by something that comes in through the air. A spirit comes in through the air. It's true, something does come in through the air, but it's not the same kind of spirit. And it is not gotten rid of, say, by shaking a snake over you, but quinine does help malaria, etc. So if you're sick, I would advise that you go to the witch doctor, because he's the man in the tribe who knows the most about the disease. On the other hand, it is not a science. It has not been checked by experiment carefully, and there's no way that you will find no place that will give you a list of the number of cases in which it works and the number of cases in which it doesn't work and so on. The other branches of psychology are perhaps less interesting, which involve things like the physiology of sensation, what happens in the eye, what happens in the brain. One of the most interesting technical problems, which may or may not be called psychology, well, there's things like reflexes and so on. Well, one of the central problems of the mind, if you will, or the nervous system, is this. If an animal learns something, then he can do something different than he could before. But he still must be inside different if it's made out of Adam. In what way? We do not know where to look or what to look for when something is memorized something. We do not know what it means or what change there is in the nervous system when a fact is learned. And this is a very important problem which has not been solved at all. Assuming, however, that there's some kind of memory thing, the brain is such an enormous mass of interconnecting wires and nerves and interconnections that it probably can't be analyzed in a straightforward manner. Instead, however, there is an analog of this to computing machine and computing machine elements, in which they also have a lot of lines, and they have some kind of an element analogous, perhaps, to the synapse or connection from one nerve to the other. And so it is a very interesting subject, which I haven't the time to discuss further, the relationship between thinking and computing machines. It must be appreciated that all this subject will tell you very little about the real complexities of ordinary human behavior. It's going to take a long time before we get to there. It's only we must start much further back. If you can figure out how a dog works, you're going pretty far. You say, oh, but human beings are so different than it. I know, but dogs are so much easier to understand. And nobody knows how dogs work. Now I'd like to mention the limitations of physics, to point out that there is a kind of question which exists in many of the sister sciences, which is not in the physics. Oh, first, by the way, in order for physics, in a theoretical way, other than making instruments, to be useful, the knowledge of physics to be useful to a science, the science must be able to supply to the physicist a description in a physicist's language of what it is, the object is. If say, why does a frog jump? The physicist can't say anything. But if you tell me what a frog is, that there's so and so many molecules, there's a nerve running from it and so on, it's different. You see, and so if you tell more or less what the Earth is like, more or less what the stars are like, are made out of, then we can start to figure it out. And in the biological system, in order for physical theory to be of any use, you must know where the atoms are located. In order to understand the chemistry, you've got to know precisely what atoms is this red-looking junk. Otherwise, you can't analyze it. So that's one limitation, of course. But there's a kind of problem in the sister sciences which is not in the physics. And I might call that, for lack of a better term, the historical question. How did it get that way, is the question. If you understand all about biology, you still want to know, how did those things that are on the Earth now get there? Well, as the theory of evolution is an important part of biology. In geology, not only do you want to know how the mountains are forming, but how the entire Earth was formed in the beginning, the origin of the solar system, and so on. And that, of course, leads you into knowing what kind of matter there was in the world. Where did the stars, how did the stars evolve? What were the initial conditions? That's a problem of astronomical history. Again, shortage of time doesn't permit me. I hope that maybe in some other lectures I can tell you more about what is found out in astronomy about the formation of stars, the formation of the elements from which we have been made, and perhaps some remarks on the origin of the universe. But I can't do that now. There's so much I can't do. There is, in physics at the present time, no historical question that's being studied. We do not have a question, here are the laws of physics, how did they get that way? We do not imagine at the moment that the laws of physics are somehow changing with time and they were different in the past than they are in the present. But of course that may be, and if the moment that that is, then the historical question of physics will be wrapped up with the rest of the history of the universe And then the physicists will be talking about the same problems as the history of the universe that astronomers and geologists and biologists talk about. Finally, if you want a problem that's very old and that hasn't been solved, that's not the problem of finding out new fundamental particles, but something that's been left over from a long time back for over 100 years, and in which nobody in physics has been able to really analyze it mathematically satisfactorily, and which furthermore is of great importance to the sister sciences, that's the analysis of circulating or turbulent fluids. We saw it in the stars that can't, whose evolution, if you watch the analysis of the evolution of stars, there comes a point where you can deduce that it's going to start convection. And then you can't figure out anymore what should happen. A few million years later, it explodes. But you can't figure out the interval. You can't analyze the weather. You don't know the patterns of motions that there should be inside an Earth that has a hot center. The simplest problem to explain it is to take a pipe that's very long and to push water through it at high speed and ask to put so and so many gallons of water through that pipe. How much pressure is needed per foot? No one can analyze it from first principles, from the equations of water. If the water flows very slowly, or if you use a thick goo like honey, then you can do it nicely, and you'll find that in your textbooks. But what you really can't do is honest to God wet water really running through a pipe. And that's a central problem that we ought to solve someday. We had not. So there are some relations of physics and the sciences. A poet, I think it is, who once said, "The whole universe is in a glass of wine." I don't know. I don't think we'll ever know in what sense he meant that. For the poets don't write to be understood. But it is true that if you look at a glass of wine closely enough, you will see the entire universe. There are the things of physics, the twisting liquid, the reflections in the glass, and our imagination adds the atoms. It evaporates, depending on the wind and weather. The glass is a distillation of the Earth's rocks, and in its composition, as we've seen, the secret of the universe's age and the evolution of the stars. What strange array of chemicals are in the wine? How did they come to be? There are the ferments, the enzymes, the substrates, and the products. And there in wine was found the great generalization. All life is fermentation. Nor can you discover the chemistry of wine without discovering, as did Pasteur, the cause of much disease. How vivid is the claret, pressing its existence into the consciousness that watches it. And if our small minds, for some convenience, divides this glass of wine, this universe, into parts, to physics, biology, geology, astronomy, psychology, and all, remember that nature doesn't know it. So we should put it all back together and not forget at last what it's for. Let it give us one final pleasure more. Drink it up and forget about it all.
That ought to take him.
You're a pretty good poet yourself.
This lecture, Conservation of Energy, was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on October 6th, 1961. The California Institute of Technology.
There will be no summary of the previous lecture. There's no summary of the previous lecture, just to remember whatever you can remember from it. No vital points. The next two lectures after today will be given by Professor Matt Sands, because I'm going to a meeting in Brussels. So, and I'll come back the Tuesday following. Today's lecture is on one of the laws of physics, and beginning, of course, the detail looking at the different aspects of physics. We've just finished our description of things in general, and now we look at more specifically in particular what a law of physics looks like. And so I picked one out to illustrate the ideas and the kind of reasoning that might be used in, say, theoretical physics. So the lecture today is on the conservation of energy. There is a fact, or if you want to call it a law, governing all natural phenomena that's known to date. There's no exception known to this. It's exact, as far as we know. And the law is called the conservation of energy. It states, there is a certain quantity, which we call energy, that doesn't change in the manifold changes which nature undergoes. Now, that's a very abstract idea, because it's a mathematical principle. It says that there's a numerical quantity that doesn't change when something happens. It's not a description of a mechanism or anything. It's just a strange fact that you can calculate some number, and when you're all finished watching nature go through her tricks, you calculate the number again, and it's the same. Something like, the bishop is on the red square now, and after a number of moves, details unknown, it's still on some red square. It's a law of this nature. Since it's an abstract idea, I would like to illustrate the meaning of it with a rather peculiar, silly example, but it does illustrate the idea. I want you to imagine a child, perhaps Dennis the Menace, who has blocks. But you must appreciate that these blocks are absolutely indestructible and cannot be divided in pieces. They're just, each is the same as the others. And we'll suppose that he has, say, 28 blocks. Now, this child is put into a room by his mother in the beginning of the day with his 28 blocks. And at the end of the day, I don't know why she's so curious, but she counts the blocks very carefully and discovers a phenomenal law that no matter what he does with the blocks, there are always 28 blocks. So this goes on for a number of days until one day there are 27 blocks. But a little looking around shows that there's some under the rug. You have to be careful to make sure that you look everywhere in order to make sure that the number of blocks doesn't change. One day, however, the number of blocks appears to change. There are only 26 blocks. Careful investigation indicates that the window was open, and now looking outside, you can find the other two blocks. So you bring them back in again, and everything's all right. Another day, careful count indicates the existence of 30 blocks. This causes a considerable consternation until it's realized that Bruce came to visit and he owns blocks and left perhaps a few. So after we've gotten rid of some of these things, that we close the window, we don't let Bruce in, then we see everything's going along all right until one time when we count there are 25 blocks. But there's a box in the room, the toy box that the boy has, and the mother goes to open the toy box, but the boy says, no, don't open my toy box, and screams. He doesn't want the man. The mother is not allowed to open the toy box. Being, however, extremely curious and somewhat ingenious, she invents a scheme. She knows that a block weighs 3 ounces, so she weighs the box at a time when she sees 28 blocks, and it weighs 16 ounces, say. So the next time when she wants to check, she weighs the box again, subtract 16 ounces, and divide by 3. So she discovers the following. Number of blocks that you can see that you have to add to this, number of blocks seen, plus weight of box minus 16 ounces divided by 3 ounces, and then it's constant every time, up to a point. There then become some gradual deviations. There appear some deviations, but careful study indicates that that dirty water that's in the bathtub is changing its level. In other words, the child is throwing blocks into the water. You can't see it because it's so dirty, but you can find out how many blocks are in the water by adding another term to this formula, which is height of water in tub minus 6 inches divided by a quarter of an inch, because each block that goes in is a quarter of an inch. And so with a gradual increase in the complexity of the world, you find a whole series of terms representing ways of calculating how many blocks are in places where you're not allowed to look. And as a result of this, it's possible to find a complex formula, a quantity which has to be computed, which always stays the same in this situation. Now, I will now describe the analog of this to the conservation of energy. The most remarkable aspect of it is that I want you to abstract from this picture. First, there are no blocks. You never see the blocks. So you take away that term. Then you discover yourself calculating more or less abstract things. The analog has the following points in it. First, sometimes when you're figuring out the energy, some of it leaves the system and goes away, or sometimes some comes in. So in order to verify the conservation of energy, you've got to be careful that you haven't put any in or taken any out. Second, that energy has a large number of different forms, and that there's a formula for every one of the different forms. I've written a number of the forms here. I see I left out elastic energy. And there's a formula for every one of these things. If we find out what the formulas are and then total them up, it won't change if you, except for going in and out. I'll give you that. Well, we can leave that down if you want. So that's the relation of the analogy. It is important to realize that in physics today, we do not have any knowledge of what energy is. My analogy is bad because we do not have a picture in physics today that energy comes in little blobs of a definite amount. It does not that way. And it is not definite blocks, but there are formulas for calculating some numerical quantity. When you add it all together, it gives 28. Always the same. We have no deeper understanding of it than this. And it is an abstract thing and doesn't tell you the mechanism or the reasons for the various formulas. Now, the conservation of energy can only be understood if we have the formula for all these things. And I could, of course, list the various formulas for different forms of energy. We call these things different forms of energy, different hidden ways of calculating the number of blocks. However, I want to amuse us today by discussing the formula for gravitational energy on the surface of the Earth here, not going very far away. And I wanted to derive this formula in a way that has nothing to do with history. It's simply a set of reasoning which I have invented for this particular lecture. And it's patterned after a very excellent argument by Mr. Carnot on the efficiency of steam engines, but it's applied here to calculate or to understand the law of how to calculate the energy and what the conservation of energy is in the case of gravitational energy. So what I want you to do is to consider weightlifting machines. That is a machine which has this property that you put a weight here, it lifts another weight by lowering some other. I want also to make an hypothesis, which is that there's no such a thing as perpetual motion with these weightlifting machines. In fact, that there's no perpetual motion at all is a general statement of the conservation of energy law. I must be careful to define perpetual motion. First, let's apply it to weightlifting machines. If you've lifted and lowered a lot of weights, take the weights off, you can restore them and restore the machine to the original condition, and find when you're all finished that the net result is to have lifted a weight, then you have a perpetual motion machine because you can use that lifted weight to run something else. Provided that the machine which lifted the weight is brought back to exactly the same condition as it was before. And furthermore, that it's completely self-contained, that it hasn't received the energy to lift that weight from some external, but Bruce's blocks haven't been thrown in. Now, I have a very simple weightlifting machine here. Here's a machine for lifting weights 3 units strong, which I put on this panel, by placing I weight on this panel. In order to get the thing to work right, however, I'll explain about this. You have to lift this little thing. Now, we just don't worry about that, but that lifts this. That lifts this. On the other hand, I could lift the 1 unit weight by lowering the 3 unit weight, provided I cheat a little bit by lifting the one on this side. I want you to realize in any actual lifting machine, I have to add a little extra to get it to run. Please disregard that temporarily. The ideal machines won't require that. They don't exist, and we'll come back and discuss that little business that in order to make it work, I have to move this. The machine that I have here is, in the sense, almost reversible. That is, if it'll lift a weight of 3 by lowering a weight of 1, then it will also lift the weight of one the same amount by lowering the three the same amount. Nearly. So we'll imagine that there are two classes of machines, those which are not reversible. This is really not reversible because I have to fiddle around with these little extra weights. But we have a machine, so a general machine is not reversible. In fact, any real machine is not precisely reversible. But as we improve the fulcrum and the levers and so on, we find that the amount of stuff that has to be lifted gets weaker and weaker. And so, with our imagination, we idealize to the possible existence of a reversible weightlifting machine. So suppose that there were such a thing. Suppose now that I have a reversible machine which does this. A one unit weight, let's say a pound or any other marker for the unit, one unit weight is lowered by 1 foot, say, or any other unit of distance, doesn't make any difference. And when this happens, the machine lifts a weight three units, say, as this one does. And that's all the machines I'm going to consider now, all the various devices. This is the simplest possible one. I get screws and axles, inclined planes, and all kinds of levers and machinery can be inside. But the net result of the machine that I want to discuss is that it takes a 1 pound weight, lowers it 1 foot, and in doing so, lifts a 3 pound weight some distance. Now let's suppose that we have machine A and this reversible machine. And this particular reversible machine lifts the 3 pounds a distance X. And now I have another machine, a machine B, which is not necessarily reversible, is not reversible, or is, whichever you want, is or is not important. Let's say it isn't for the sake of argument. It lifts three a distance y. Now what I'm going to prove is that y is not higher than x, that it is impossible to build a machine that will lift a weight any higher than will be lifted by a reversible machine. Let's see why. Well, let's suppose that y were higher than x. I don't have to draw pictures, I can wave my arms, look. You take a weight, one, and you lower it 1 foot with the machine B, and that lifts the weight three up a distance y. Now you lower that. See, if y is greater, I'm going to prove, or let's say what I'm going to prove. Y is not higher than x. Suppose it were. And I've lifted the weight higher than I need, than x, the distance, say, y is up here. And suppose x is only this high. Then I can lower the weight from y to x, obtaining free energy, free power. And then use the reversible machine A running backwards, which, according to this, will lower a 3 pound weight, x, and lift the 1 pound weight 1 foot, which will put the 1 pound weight back where it was before. And I'm ready to use machine B again. In other words, I lift with machine B by lowering the weight 1 pound. I lift the thing 3 pounds up Y. Then I lower it a distance X and get my 1 pound weight back before. But since X is less than Y, I have a little bit left to go. I can make the thing do something on its fall between Y and X. And therefore, I have perpetual motion. So if Y were higher than X, I would have perpetual motion, which I assumed was impossible. So therefore, with those assumptions, I deduced that y is not higher than x. Therefore, of all machines that can be designed, the reversible machine is the best. No matter how you figure out with the wheels and the gears, you'd better try to make it reversible. Now I'll show you something else. All reversible machines must lift at exactly the same height. Because suppose that B were really reversible also. Well, the argument that B is reversible, that Y is not higher than X, is of course just as good as it was before. So Y is not higher than X. B is now reversible, however. And I could make my argument the other way around. You stop and think a minute, you'll see what I mean. I could make the machines run in the opposite order. So I could just interchange the B and A in the argument. And I can easily prove the other thing, that X is not higher than Y. In other words, if I had two reversible machines and one lifted higher than the other, then I can use that extra difference and then make one run the other backwards to keep the cycle going. So therefore, if I have a set of reversible machine, all reversible machines lift the same distance, no matter how they're constructed. If they drop 1 pound, 1 foot, and lift 3 pounds, the same distance, no matter how they're constructed. This, then, is a very remarkable observation because it permits us to analyze the heights at which different machines are going to lift something without looking at the interior mechanism. And we know right away that if somebody has concocted a series of levers that's enormously elaborate, that lifts this a certain distance, and I compare it to a simple lever like this, which is a fundamentally reversible, I know this is going to lift it no higher, no less high. I know exactly how high it's going to lift, and I know that it's no use trying to redesign the machine to get greater height. So you see that this X is a very important general proposition for all machines. To summarize, every reversible machine, no matter what, or no matter how it operates, which drops 1 pound by 1 foot and lifts a 3 pound weight, always lifts at the same distance X, irrespective of the machine, and therefore something in great generality. It's a universal law of great utility. The next question is, of course, what's X? After all, it's an interesting law to discover because it's the same for all machines and doesn't depend on any particular one. So I can get the X that way. One way is to invent a reversible machine and figure out how high it lifts. But I have a more ingenious argument for you that tells us what X is, and so I'd entertain you by the following argument. Suppose that we have a reversible machine which is going to lift this distance X, 3 for 1. I set up a set of 3 balls here. This is only a rack to hold the balls, and it doesn't move. This ball is being held on a stay up here at a distance 1 foot above the ground. The machine lifts, if I put, this is the other part, this is the machine here. There's this platform and this piece here. And the machine is of this nature that if this goes down 1 foot, it can lift 3 balls, lowering one, by a distance X. Now I arrange that the platform which holds the 3 balls has 3 shelves, or 2 shelves on the floor, 3 shelves, exactly spaced at distance X. And I further arrange that my rack, which holds the balls over here, are all spaced at distance X. I measured the distance X and I found out what it is, and so I laid this thing out and I'm all ready for the argument. Now I roll the balls from here to here, and I suppose that that takes no energy because I don't change the height. So I load the balls onto the platforms and I get into this condition. Now, the machine operates in the way it's supposed to operate. This reversible machine operates. It lowers this ball to the floor, and it lifts this rack a distance X. Now you see how cleverly and ingeniously arranged is this rack here. These are spaced at a distance X, and so these balls are right even with the platforms that they can be rolled out onto, and so I unload the balls here. Now, having unloaded the balls, I can restore the machine to the original condition without the ball. That's the property of the machine, that it can be, that after you've lifted the weights, you can restore the machine to this original condition without any extra energy. So now I have 3 balls on the upper 3 shelves and 1 down here, naturally, having lifted essentially these 3 balls up. But you see, the funny thing about it is that in a certain way of speaking, I haven't lifted these 2 at all in a way of speaking. Because after all, there were balls on that shelf before. There are still balls on those shelves. So in the net resulting effect of the whole thing, really, has been to lift the ball from here to here. 1 ball, you see? Net result. In order to illustrate better, suppose that we rearrange the balls by moving this one over here and this one over here. Then you'll see better what I mean. Now, I roll this ball into this hole and roll this ball across over to this position. Then you'll see that these 3 balls are just exactly the same as they were in the initial condition, but that the fourth ball here is at some other height, which is 3x. If this 3x exceeds 1 foot, then I can lower the ball from here to here, running some other machine and getting power. free, and then I'm back in the initial condition and can run my apparatus again. Therefore, 3x cannot exceed 1 foot. For 3x exceeds 1 foot, I can make perpetual motion. Now, likewise, if you can prove that 1 foot cannot exceed 3x, I leave it to you to work it out. All you have to do is to start around the other way, make all the whole machine run the opposite way. It's a reversible machine, and the same argument can be carried the other way, in which you lower things. In other words, if the 3x were lower when you started out than the 1 foot, then you can show by running the same argument in the opposite direction that you would make perpetual motion. Therefore, 3x is neither greater nor less than a foot, and we discover then, by argument alone, the law that the x is 1/3 of a foot. I'm sure the generality is clear to you that if 1 pound falls a distance, a reversible machine can lift 3 pounds to 1/3 the distance. Or if 1 pound falls a certain distance in operating a reversible machine, then the machine can lift p pounds a piece of the distance, huh? So 7 pounds a seventh of the distance, and so forth. And that now gives us the law of, we can state the law of the conservation of energy this way, then. Another way to put the same thing is the following. That 3 pounds times the height lifted, which in our problem here was x, is equal to 1 pound times the height, the distance lowered, which is 1 foot in this quest case, or 12 inches, or whatever you want to. Excuse me. Yeah. So, another way of saying this is the following. If I take all the weights and multiply them by the heights that they are now above the floor, all weights in the problem, multiply all the weights by the heights above the floor, and then let the machine operate, and then multiply all the weights by all the heights again, there'll be no change. That is the sum of this for all the weights. This symbol means add. Weights times heights for all the different weights added together is unchanged. We'd have to generalize a single case where we moved only one weight to the case where when we lower one, we lift several different ones. But you can use the same kind of arguing to deduce this too in a more general case by having more elaborate machines. I just illustrate the type of reasoning, but this is deducible from this type of reasoning. That is, if we take the machine, for instance, that starts with one up here at a foot high, and three at the on the floor, and then after the machine is operated, the one is on the floor, and the three is up in the air by the distance x, then the way of calculating this way is the following. In the beginning, it's 1 pound by 1 foot. That's for the first weight, plus 3 pounds times 0 feet. How convenient. It's easy to calculate it. And that turns out to be the same as 1 pound times 0 feet plus 3 pounds times x feet. Of course, it checks every time. That's why I'm telling you about it. It's the same thing. This, we call this term, the sum of the weights times the heights, gravitational energy, the energy which an object has because of its relationship in space relative to the Earth. And the formula for gravitational energy, as long as you're not too far from the Earth, the force weakens as you go higher. So this is only approximate. You might try to find out where the error is in this analysis if the heights are so high that the force weakens. Gravitational energy has the formula, the sum for all the various particles. We don't have to remember the sum. It's always the sum of all the things that are there. You add it together. Weight times height. And that's an illustration of it. Now, the question is, of course, it's a very beautiful set of reasoning. The only thing is, maybe it's not true. After all, nature doesn't have to go along with the reasoning. Perhaps, for instance, perpetual motion is in fact possible. So that some of the assumptions may be wrong, or I may have made a mistake in reasoning. So it's always necessary to check. And it turns out experimentally, in fact, to be true. Incidentally, the general name of energy, which has to do with location relative to something else, is called potential energy. In this particular case, more specifically, I would call this gravitational potential energy, to give you a high-class word. If it's a question of electrical forces against which you're working, instead of gravitational forces, you're lifting charges away from some other charge with a lot of levers, then the energy content is called electrical potential energy. The general principle is that the change in the energy is the force times the distance that it's moved, that your force is pushed, and that's a change in energy in general. But we come back to a lot of these things and make them when we go on with the course, of course. Now, this principle, the conservation of energy, is very useful for figuring out what will happen in a number of circumstances. And I'll illustrate some of those. Just because you probably learned an awful lot of laws in high school to figure out what happens under different circumstances, I assure you they're all the same thing. So you didn't have to memorize 75 rules. You could figure it all out. Take the simplest example as an inclined plane. Suppose that we have an inclined plane, which is happily on a 3-4-5 triangle. And we have here a weight, which we'll say a 1-pound weight on the inclined plane with a pulley here. And on the other side of the pulley is another weight, X or W, say unknown. We want to know how heavy this has to be to just balance that. Now, how can we figure that out? Well, we say, if it's just balanced, then it's reversible to move up and down. And I can consider the following situation. In the initial circumstance, I suppose that the weight, the 1-pound weight is down here, and that the weight W, say, is at the top, wherever it is, that is, and there's a pulley here, so. And then after, when it slid down in a reversible way, now we can do it back and forth because it's balanced, then we have here the 1-pound weight at the top of the thing, and the weight W is down here some distance or other from the place it was before. What distance? Oh, the slant distance, 5 feet, or five whatever they are, 5. So the weight W has fallen 5 while the weight 1 has lifted 5. No. It's the height above the ground, the formula says. How far did we lift the weight? We only lifted the weight 3 feet. So therefore, we lifted 1 pound by 3 feet, and we lowered W pounds by 5 feet, and therefore W is 3/5 of a pound. So you see, you can deduce that by very cleverly from the conservation of energy. Cleverness, however, is relative. It can be deduced in a way that's even more brilliant from the conservation of energy by a way invented by Stevinus, and which is on his gravestone, his tombstone. That's his tombstone. And that explains that it has to be 3/5 of a pound. Because it doesn't go around, says he. And it's evident that this part of the chain is balanced. So the pull on these 5 weights here must balance the pull on the 3 weights here. Into whatever the ratios of these legs are, and it's even true if it's a double incline. And so you see, by looking here, that it's 3/5 of a pound. So this was clever, but that's even more clever. It's 1600. Anyway, if you get an epitaph like that on your gravestone, you're doing fine. Let me illustrate with the more complicated problems that the same thing works, and you don't have to. This is very simple, but let's take one of those wonderful things that they're always annoying you with. Something like this, you see. I'll just make one of these up. I have one made up. I have a screw thread, so a jack, you see.